of Jewish lives. It's the only country in the world that said any and all Jews that can physically make your way to our borders, you're in. We're not going to support you. We're going to rely on your fellow Jewish people who are already residing in China to support you. And they did. But you're in. We will turn no Jew away. But and many people in America do already know that because of that policy, 25,000 to 30,000 Jews survived the war in Shanghai. The only ones who died, died of natural causes. China did something much bigger that nobody in the West is aware of. My researcher found it in an digital Chinese military history archive and verified it in multiple places. In 1939, the acting premier of China, H.H. Kung, very rich man, had gone to grad school in Berlin with some Jewish classmates. They were murdered on the street in horrible ways, one in Geneva and one in Hamburg. These were powerful, wealthy bankers. And Kung realized, if they can't survive the Nazis, no one is safe. He went to Germany and met with Hitler and asked him to please reconsider this persecution of the Jews. Hitler, of course, turned him down.
Right there, that's trippy, and I bet nobody knows that.
Wait,
keep going.
Wait till you hear what Kung did in response. He goes back to China deflated, and he goes to his friend Sun Fo. And they decide, we have to do something to save the Jewish people. These two men had influence. Sun Fo was the son of Sun Yat-sen. Kung, direct descendant of Confucius, whose Chinese name is Kung Fu-zi. So they had real influence. Why, that's royalty in China. The descendant of Confucius and the son of Sun Yat-sen together went before the legislature and in 1939 persuaded them to pass a law setting aside two counties in Yunnan province. This is land adjoining Burma. If you can visualize China's southwest corner, they just built the Burma Road through this land, making inaccessible land fertile, good climate, accessible, ripe for development. They set aside these two counties as a permanent, autonomous, semi-autonomous resettlement zone that they were going to cede by bringing 100,000 Jewish refugees to Burma by ship and then overland over British-held Burma to the border of China, where they would be resettled in their new land. Huge amount of money was raised, smuggled to southwest China. The two people carrying the money were intercepted and murdered by Japanese agents who did not want the West giving any sympathy to China and helping them against Japan on account of their saving 100,000 Jewish lives. That was the long game, I'm sure. There was no more keeping it secret at this point. Hitler got wind of it, threatened Chiang Kai-shek, and it was closed down, put in a drawer, forgotten, unknown in the West, that China tried to establish a 20th century arc during the Holocaust, to be started with 100,000 people chosen for different age levels, different skills, different backgrounds to start a new life. What would the world be like now? There would be a million Jews living between China and Burma, maybe 2 million. Everything would be different. Mm. So I had to dramatize this.
Right. And that was even at a time when, if I'm not mistaken, I think that our government was turning ships full of Jewish people away from our shores.
I think you are right.
So anyway, we are speaking with Nicole Manis. Her newest book is Night in Shanghai. Nicole, you know, okay, you live in Portland. How did you become so immersed in Chinese history and culture? Picking up this book, there's no way. You obviously have a passionate adoration for history. I'm just putting it that way, right?
Yes, I love history.
And I think this book is maybe even more historical in its way than your other couple novels, but I haven't read them both. So, but how did this start? What is your connection with China?
My connection with China personally is that in 1976, I knew nothing about China, nothing about Chinese history, but I did have a degree in history. I knew history, basically, nothing to do with Asian history. That year, when Zhou Enlai died and Mao Zedong died, at least this much news penetrated the bamboo curtain. We did know that the two top leaders of China died in that year. When that happened, just because I had studied history, nothing to do with China, it was immediately clear to me that China would now emerge and become a world power. So I knew it would take 25 to 30 years, but I also knew that there was a big opportunity for a 24-year-old girl who might like to get into a chance to do business in a new place when the getting was good, because I was one of the first to think of it, and only because of that, I was able to get the Chinese government to invite me to come over there, and I start a small textile business. I imported woolen piece goods to the U.S. and Italy from China for 18 years. I had to learn about China to do that. Relationships are business in China. You can't sustain a business for almost two decades without getting to know the people. And I did. I learned their language. I learned about their culture, and I learned about their history. It was a greater... I did it because I wanted to do business a little more effectively, but instead, it was an amazing gift. Learning their language allowed me to begin to truly understand China. And it's never stopped fascinating me. When I began to realize that most Americans really don't understand China that way.
We're afraid of China. We've been told since birth to be afraid of China.
Sure. But and China's a powerful country. It has the largest population in the world. And they financially conduct their national life in a different way than we do, which is good and bad in perhaps equal measure. But allowing people to understand China better on a human level, that's my only goal. And as a novelist, I think I'm suited to do that. You know, for many years in China, when I was learning the language, people would grab me and say to me in Chinese, "You must tell the world what we have experienced. The West doesn't know. You must tell them." And I used to say to them in the 70s, "I'm a kid. Nobody's going to listen to me. But thank you. Tell me your life story." So in a way, I write these books to keep my promise, to the promise I made to hundreds of people over the years. I'll try to tell your story to the world, and also to share history that people just aren't aware of. When I come across African-American history that people aren't aware of, and Holocaust history that people aren't aware of, the fact that it comes from China is less important than that's part of our history as Americans. And by the way, our song form is our history as Americans. We may export democracy with some success, but we kick butt when it comes to exporting music and cinema. Our culture is what has changed the world. And this is a novel about how American culture, what is more American than jazz? American culture went into Asia, changed the way a whole part of the world hears a song, and stayed there. That's a permanent effect.
And we're speaking with Nicole Moniz and her newest book, Night in Shanghai. Have you ever read either of Langston Hughes' two autobiographies?
You know I have.
He lived such a long life, he had to have two autobiographies.
Yes,
one of my favorite parts was when he's touring Russia with a whole bunch of African-American people, and they've got a great big record player, and they've got probably 100 pounds worth of records, and that just cracks me up.
Those guys never went anywhere without, well, I mean, not just those guys, all music-loving people in that era took their Victrolas and their 78s with them in the trunk when they went on an ocean voyage.
Which is like traveling with a 500-pound baby. Every part of it's going to break, and it weighs a ton.
And you wouldn't imagine a day or a week of your life without it, so you take it.
I'm so glad
you mentioned Hughes, because when I first found out that Black American musicians had powered the Chinese jazz age, I really wanted to find out who was there, who left behind a first-person account.
Because that's where a lot of this novel came from.
Yes, I found out not only what people's lives were like, but in their own voices, because they left their own accounts, so I could literally hear how they saw it and how they described it. But it was when I came upon this paragraph in Langston Hughes' autobiography that I saw the whole novel. I'll read it to you. Here's what he said. He arrived in Shanghai in 1935, and here's what he said about it. "I reached the international city of Shanghai in July, with the sun beating down on the Bund, the harbor full of Chinese junks, foreign liners, and warships from all over the world. It was hot as blazes. I didn't know a soul in the city. But hardly had I climbed into a rickshaw than I saw riding in another along the Bund a Negro who looked exactly like a Harlemite. I stood up in my rickshaw and yelled, 'Hey, man!' He stood up in his rickshaw and yelled, 'What you saying?' We passed each other in the crowded street, and I never saw him again." That was the inspiration for this novel. I wanted to find out what happened to that Negro who looked exactly like a Harlemite, who vanished in a rickshaw in the crowded street. Langston Hughes never caught a glimpse of him again. He spent weeks and weeks in Shanghai, never met him. The man was in another orchestra that Langston's friends didn't know. And that's where my novel started. I wanted to follow him.
You know, and I just have to point this out, too. The thing about African-American soldiers, the thing about African-Americans in World War II, the thing about the United States of America is that kind of a lot of black men were lynched in the United States during and immediately after World War II because they had the nerve to walk down the street in their military uniforms. And there's photographs of this. It is it is a historic reality. So when we beat our chests about, you know, this great American democracy and China owns our debt and they're the bad guys, we really need to stop what we're doing and learn about who we are. This is KBOO Portland. This show is Between the Covers, and we're in the studio with our guest, Nicole Moniz. She's the author of Lost in Translation, The Last Chinese Chef. That's the one I need to pick up because it's about food. And her newest book, Night in Shanghai. You know, I was privileged years ago, Nicole, to interview Iris Chang. And then after her death, yes, I interviewed a colleague of hers who wrote a book about her life. Iris Chang wrote this doorstopper book called The Narrative History of the Chinese in America. I had no idea how much of the landscape I had lived my life in was built by Chinese immigrants. Can you talk about that a little bit? Who was your biggest inspiration or influence in these intricate, ambitious novels you're writing about that include, again, this history that we have in common with China that is right there hiding in plain sight?
I think that the 37 years I have spent working in China and involved in China has opened my eyes to different ways of seeing the divisions between people that come up because of ethnic reasons or religious reasons or reasons of color. Chinese people have a different set of attitudes about these things than we do. They're not necessarily better. In some ways, I would say they are more prone to stereotyping people of color than Americans are at this point in our two countries' history. But one thing that totally floored me during all the time I have been in China is that their attitude toward Jewish people is completely different than the attitude I experience in America. It made me see anti-Semitism in America because it's absent in China. Chinese people are really proud of their record in helping Jews during the Holocaust, but they also, there's a respect for Jewish people that's evident. For example, I come from a WASP background, at least according to my formal family history. DNA might have something, has something a little different to say about that, but let's not go into that now. But family history, all the way WASP. When I married a Jewish man, I didn't get such a great reception from that, from my birth family about that. In China, the opposite. Congratulations. You couldn't have done better. Everyone knows Jewish men make the best husbands and the best fathers. And the respect for the value placed on education between the two cultures is one of the big reasons for that. The scholarship that's always marked Jewish community in the West is something that Chinese people, by virtue of Confucianism and their culture, deeply respect. And there have been Jews in China for 1,000 years. They're not an unknown people to the Chinese.
Well, that's the other big comparison, you know, the African diaspora and the Jewish diaspora.
Yeah.
And they have intertwined all through history. And the country of Turkey has a piece of that too. But again, now we're all over the map.
Let's think about how those two things, black history and the Holocaust, literally came together in Shanghai. Come back to what you said at the top of this interview about cabaret. When those 25,000 Jewish refugees arrived in Shanghai, the whole city felt the difference. People literally wrote in their memoirs of this time that for the first time in Shanghai, after the refugees arrived, the cabarets in Shanghai had wit every bit as biting as in Berlin. For the first time, the coffee shops had real Sachertort, mit Schlag. And let's not forget the musicians. Classically trained musicians poured in, especially from Vienna, where 10,000 lives were saved by the Chinese consul, Ho Fengshan. Among those 10,000 lives were many formally trained musicians who replenished the pit orchestras in Shanghai, the Shanghai Symphony, and also the street music scene in Shanghai, which is how my protagonist, Thomas Green, survives after the Japanese occupation. When the Japanese occupied Shanghai in 37, they killed the serious jazz scene, leaving many black American musicians marooned there with significant difficulty in earning their passage home. Passage home was quite expensive in relation to people's average salaries at that time. It was more difficult to save your passage than you might think. So the relationship between these refugee musicians who poured in, particularly from Vienna, and the black musicians who were marooned there became an obvious joining of talents and necessity. As two people who are dispossessed for different reasons, two groups of people struggle to make a living as musicians and find their common ground in music.
Mm. And we are speaking with Nicole Moniz. We're talking about her newest novel, Night in Shanghai. She is an award-winning novelist and a longtime business person. I want to come back to this question I had earlier. Who has been your biggest inspiration or influence as a writer?
Many books that I have read about China have influenced me to feel that I too would like to make a contribution by helping to improve popular understanding of China. I've chosen to do it through novels because, to me, what I learn in novels and see in films, that's what stays with me. The narrative arts are what stays with me. I love nonfiction. I personally feel most influenced by the narrative arts, so that's what I write. In terms of China, the people that have most influenced me would be Iris Chang. It would be Eileen Zhang or Eileen Chang, who wrote most famously Lust Caution, a great writer. It would be writers who like Ba Jin and Lao Shi that were very important in the 20s. But overall, the single writer that made me decide at the age of 20 to become a writer had nothing to do with China. I realize this is a stereotypical platitude to raise his name, but it was Borges. Because of his joining of intellectual life with writing. He was the National Librarian of Argentina, an amazing intellect. He loved history. He loved philosophy. He'd read everything in Greek, in Norse, not just in Spanish and English. And he managed to write stories and poems that allowed you into his knowledge, that allowed you to share his knowledge of all these matters without ever taking your joy away from the story or the poem. And it was long after I discovered him that I became interested in China. But his example of combining erudition with entertainment was my first huge inspiration. Once when I, when you sign a contract with a major publisher, they give you a one sentence description of what they think it is you're expected to accomplish. And when I signed my contract for The Last Chinese Chef, I laughed out loud that Houghton Mifflin wrote in there, the novel about haute Chinese cuisine, erudite yet entertaining. That is my goal. To be erudite yet entertaining. And my books are published in 25 countries in 23 languages, so they are clearly entertaining to people. And Alan Chews on NPR has called Night in Shanghai historical fiction at its best. A lot of people can't put it down. I'm glad about that. But my goal is to enlarge understanding while you can't put it down.
All right. Now, I've got one last great big question because we're running out of show. What else do we Americans not know about China?
I think we know a lot. I think if I could answer that question in a slightly different way, where we might more productively put our emphasis on issues related to the bilateral relations between our two countries, in my opinion, might be more productively placed on environmental issues. Human rights are very important. It's natural for China, when we use our diplomatic muscle to pressure them about human rights, to respond with, well, that's what goes on in our country. And maybe you don't have a right to tell us. And that's debatable. Obviously, we wouldn't have war crimes commissions if we didn't believe, all humanity didn't believe that there were certain international standards. But the environment is different. All of the earth is affected by China's environmental mistakes and illegal acts. And we have the muscle with the world community, and we are more advanced than they in green technology. So If I could direct people's attention anywhere, I would say, let's look at the environment. Let's use our international relationship to help China cease destroying the ocean and the atmosphere that we all share.
Mm. Okay, and we are speaking with Nicole Moniz. Okay, Nicole, I'm sure you're working on a new book, but you're also pretty excited about a project that a colleague of yours has put together for your website. So I want to go out of this interview saying, how do people learn more about your work and tell us about what's on your website?
Oh,
and what is the web address?
Go to NicoleMoniz.com. M-O-N-E-S, that's all you have to remember is my name, right on the homepage is an amazing trailer that a Chinese feature film director read the manuscript of Night in Shanghai. He said, I love this book. No one has ever captured Shanghai before, and you did it. I want to make my own work of art. I'm making a trailer for the movie, because that's what I do. I make feature films and trailers. I said, but there's no movie. He said, I know. I'm making a movie trailer as if, because I see the movie, and I'm making the trailer. So we went to museums and archives all over the world, and all of them said, you're going to bring this forgotten history before the public? Please use our images. So he used these historical images and film clips to make a Ken Burns type, documentary type trailer. Check it out, NicoleMonas.com. Also there on the website are galleries of historical photos captioned. If you want to know anything more about anything I've just said, you can actually see the photos on my website.
All right. And really quickly, what are you working on next?
Not sure. My next big novel, though, might be a novel about the Shanghai Communique. That's Nixon and Kissinger negotiating the opening to China. But I'd like to write it from the Chinese point of view. And not very many Americans remember that there was an American in the Chinese camp, a woman named Nancy Tang, who was born and raised in Brooklyn, taken to China in her tween years, trained in Mandarin, and she was Mao's interpreter in front of Nixon and Kissinger. And by the way, she was immortalized in the Doonesbury comic strip as the character Honey with the big plastic glasses.
Oh my God.
So I might just write a very serious historical novel about Honey.
Wow. All right. Nicole Monas, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
You too.
Portland native, internationally famous. Her books, The Last Chinese Chef is a biggie. Lost in Translation, but this one, Night in Shanghai, people are hugging it all over the place. Keep your eyes peeled for it, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Lisa.
Lisa Loving, Between the Covers. Thanks for listening.
Joanne Rand and Jim Page. Together, Rand and Page will pack a Cascadian folk wallop celebrating Rand's new album, Still a Real World, at the Alberta Rose Theatre on Tuesday, April 8th at 8 p.m. A portion of the proceeds from this amazing show will benefit KVU, so you folk fans don't want to miss this one. For more details, go to kboo.fm and check under Community Events here at your community radio station, KBOO.
Ear to the Streets is a dynamic and stimulating conversation setting that brings together independent, hardworking Black African voices from the community to talk about the core issues impacting us that are whitewashed in mainstream America. Stay tuned for an upcoming Ear to the Streets panel discussion with a mix of revolutionary music on April 3rd, 2014 at 8 o'clock p.m. This next installment of Ear to the Streets will consist of conversations around the Black African community in Portland, Oregon, featuring Center for Self-Improvement, Moorish Science Temple, All African People's Revolutionary Party, and Par Unc Kemetic Community, with a mix of music. Again, tune in April 3rd, 2014 at 8 o'clock p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm.
Good morning. This is Black Book Talk for the month of April. I am Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman.
Hi, I'm Patricia Welch, the library lady.
And I'm Obi Hill with Reflections Mirror Image Books.
We have a very important guest here on the phone with us this morning. His name is Peniel E. Joseph, and he has written a biography on Stokely Carmichael.
Dr. Peniel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. You know, before we even get started, I just want to say thank you. This is Patricia. Thank you so much for writing this book, because for a lot of folks who were marginally interested in, on the shelf, especially a lot of young people, not really paying that much attention to the civil rights movement, I think it was a Sunday in April, and I think it was Meet the Press, and it was Stokely Carmichael and some other civil rights leaders, and that was at a time when black people were on television. We all were like, black people are on television.
Yeah.
And I just remember, you know, were all the traditional civil rights leaders, and then there was this young firebrand, and my sister and I, who must have been, I guess, maybe in the early teens, we were like, who is that? And after that, just seeing this young, attractive, dynamic, outspoken, absolutely charismatic man who was talking stuff that we had never heard, we all of a sudden perked up, became interested in the civil rights movement. When he came to Baltimore, we were there to listen. And I mean, I think for so many people, he was the portal to the civil rights movement and has not received the attention that he deserves. So thank you for doing this.
Oh, no, you're welcome. Thank you for your kind words.
Well, this is very appropriate because on this day in 1950, Carter G. Woodson passed in Washington, D.C. Of course, he is the founder of Negro History Week that we celebrate now as Black History Month. And also in 1963, the Civil Rights Forces led by Martin Luther King Jr. and F.L. Shuttlesworth launched a drive against discrimination in Birmingham, Alabama.
No, absolutely. You know, Stokely, what's so interesting to me about Stokely Carmichael is the way in which Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, his life spans so many different facets of the movement. Because I think that in his own lifetime, in the late 60s, he became more famous for a time than Malcolm X. But we've written him out of that history. You know, he goes to Africa, he becomes Kwame Ture, leader of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and this unrepentant revolutionary Pan-Africanist you know, a follower of Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré. And what's interesting is that Stokely Carmichael, you know, he's from Port of Spain, Trinidad. He's got the Caribbean roots. He lives in the Deep South and also New York City, so there's the urban roots. And then he lives and works and dies in Africa. So there's a real Pan-Africanist trajectory to his own life. And what's very interesting is the way in which we've written Stokely out of the second half of the civil rights movement's heroic period. So when you write him out of events in Selma and the events that are going on in Birmingham, the freedom rides, the sit-ins of the early 60s, it really lessens the impact and the totality of his activism, right? So what's interesting for me is that doing the research on Stokely, you really got a better sense of how important an activist he was and the legacy of the activism, both as a civil rights militant and a black power revolutionary, but somebody who has a deep relationship with Martin Luther King Jr., but somebody who's really articulating, along with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the deepest criticism against the Vietnam War in 1966, who's popularizing the term not just black power, but hell no, we won't go, and who provides a blueprint for the kind of anti-imperialism that people like King and the Black Panthers and Students for a Democratic Society and other folks are going to articulate. But it's really, you know, Stokely and his activism that really are the linchpin of that, and that's been lost historically.
Well, I want to thank you, because half day I'm a third grade teacher and the other half of the day I'm the school librarian, and you have given me a hero to introduce the students to. So I really thank you. I understand that he started at a pretty young age, about 19.
Oh, yeah. You know, what's interesting is he was first arrested at 19, but he was an activist earlier than that. So he comes to the United States 2 weeks before his 11th birthday. And what's interesting is that he moves to a predominantly white section of the Bronx called Morris Park. So Stokely and his family, he's got four sisters, his mother, May Charles, and his father, Adolphus. So he's raised in a tight-knit family. He's got both parents there. He is a very precocious student. You know, one of the big things with Carmichael is that he tests into Bronx Science High School, and that was a very prestigious school, and he